So our second speaker, I think many of you will know Gwen Pascoe. Gwen has worked in agriculture and horticulture and combined with her mother's history, she's been involved in writing about the system garden at the university. Gwen's also written many books for children's reader series, such as Magic Bean in Fact. And I did look up your newest book. It is your newest book, mm-hmm. I think, isn't it? Long Views and Short Vistas. It's a type to go out there and read it. Victoria's 19th Century Public Botanic Gardens was released in 2012, where she explores the story of botanic gardens established in Melbourne and other Victorian towns in the second half of the 19th century. So that lovely combination of history of gardens and the reasons behind their establishment and their intended purpose. So welcome, Gwen. Thank you very much for offering to give a talk. And yes, we all know that funny little white building. I love the fact that you say behind boxes.
Well, it was, because it was an overheard conversation. Where will we meet? Meet me in that funny little white building behind Botany. And that's what I want to talk about. That funny little white building behind Botany. Looks a bit more dignified than it did then, I think. Okay. Just doesn't seem to want to work. Page. Up. No, back down, back down. That one.
Just that one, press
that
it.
That one. That one. Oh, okay, gone too far. Press it more gently. One up, yeah. Just go up a bit. All right, I'll try again.
There.
Right.
So just down.
That very one. Gently. Yeah. Okay, what is it, why is it there, and what does it represent? Some grand old gardens have ornamental structures called follies. But it's not one of those. Follies have no practical use but provide a point of landscape interest. But this funny little white building is not a folly. It was not for decoration. It had a practical purpose as well as representing something very much larger and older than itself. So what is it? Well, it's not Rapunzel's tower, though I've heard it referred to as that. It's not a rocket ship, and it was not originally a potting shed. It was the centre of an octagonal conservatory, erected in stages from 1866 to 75. You can see in the top one, there's a section still waiting to be erected. It cost about £1,000.
What year was that?
Between 1866 and 1875. It originally had four doors and vents which could be adjusted to control the temperature of the different sections. The conservatory was itself the centre of a circular botanic garden of about 4 acres. This was later, about 1900, came to be called the System Garden, but McCoy always called it the Botanical Garden. But we're going with System Garden. So time for a definition. A system garden, sometimes called a class ground, is a specialised botanic garden designed as a gigantic teaching aid, a herbarium of living plants arranged with according to principles of botanical classification. This 1891 plan shows where it was situated. You can see it occupied a fair space of the original property. So the second question is, why is it there? It's there because of many people. But among those who were important in the 19th century is the man who put the design onto paper, Edward Latrobe Bateman. He was involved with the design of the university grounds between 1856 and the end of 1864. He was practical as well as very skilled with in an aesthetic way. He also designed things like a boiler for the propagating house and drainage for the system garden. Next is the man who, well, he's a bit of a mystery. Not only don't we know, we don't know what he looked like, but he also transferred the plan from paper to soil. The role of William Hindman is less clear than that of Bateman. He was a very versatile and experienced gardener who may have been botanical assistant to William Hooker in Glasgow, claimed to be, but we can't prove it, and may have inspired the formation of the system garden by his account of his former occupation as a botanical porter at Trinity College Dublin, where his duties included collecting botanical specimens for the herbarium and for botany classes. You can see where his interests lay. He laid out the system garden, and he was also a very practical man, designing boilers and things like that. But he didn't stay for long. He left in 1857. Now, in contrast to him, this man worked in the garden and surrounding grounds for 41 years. This is Alexander Elliot. He's not dressed for gardening there. He was responsible for much of the garden planting and maintenance from 1860 to 1901. And then there's the champion of the system garden. Lastly, but certainly not least, was Professor McCoy. Professor of natural science, charming when he got his own way, feisty when he didn't. His relations with administrators and gardeners were turbulent. However, there would never have been a system garden if he had been less persistent. We'll talk about him a bit more later. The larger question to ask about the funny little white building is, what does it represent? It represents horticultural ambition, for the garden was large at about 4 acres, but the soil was poor and the topsoil had been removed. Reticulated water was not available until late 1859. Drainage could be a problem. Desired plant material was not always available. There were no artificial fertilisers or herbicides, while money and labour were never adequate to maintain the garden in a thriving condition. It also represents academic ambition. The University of Melbourne opened in 1855 with 16 students and 3 professors. How do you like that ratio? In a rented building. At the opening of the new buildings on the 3rd of October 1855, the Governor, Sir Charles Hotham, expressed the prevailing opinion that the university would be a waste of money unless it trained scientists and metallurgists, engineers and geologists. Full stop. It was up to McCoy, as Professor of Natural Science, which included botany, chemistry, geology and zoology, to convince the public of the practical benefits of the university. McCoy's academic empire included the museum, which became increasingly popular, and the system garden, which gave students and interested members of the public an opportunity to see botany displayed. And primarily, it represents a tradition of educational botany. This can be understood as developing from the Greek physician and teacher Dioscorides. It continued through the preparation and dispersal of various herbals describing the form and uses of common plants, with the periodic addition of unfamiliar and potentially useful plants introduced from distant places visited on voyages of discovery. The construction and planting of medicinal botanic gardens in Pisa and Padua in the 16th century and subsequent European university gardens gave botanical education a more obviously practical demonstration. In the 1850s and 60s, while the university system garden was developing, Sydney and Melbourne had their own botanic gardens, and many regional centres in Victoria were establishing their own. Although the contemporary interest in providing public parks often confused the identity of the resulting gardens. Obviously, botanical education was not limited to universities, but, as in, noted in the definition, a system garden was a specialised botanic garden designed to display plants in a way which would demonstrate botanical relationships. So a garden which came to be called a system garden represents a way of understanding the world of plants. Although such gardens had a long tradition, no two were identical because of the botanical system they were designed to display and the range of plants included. Many included medicinal plants, others herbaceous plants and annuals. How McCoy's differed is significant, I think. I've mentioned botanical systems, so I need to look briefly at this section of 19th century botany. A textbook of the time said, systematic botany has for its object the naming, describing and arranging of plants in such a manner that we may readily ascertain their names, and at the same time get an insight into their affinities and general properties, for the purpose of study or in order to obtain any satisfactory knowledge of the vast number of individuals. We should arrange them according to some definite and fixed rules. The basis of botanical systems was the arrangement of plants, and relationships were the guiding factor. There were artificial and natural systems, artificial ones based on some obvious or convenient characteristic, like the Linnaean system. Natural systems, which the system garden used, were based on the comparative development of organs and their functions, that is, on morphology and physiology. And this change professionalised botany because classification required access to herbaria, where a large number of dried specimens could be compared. A system garden could be regarded as a living herbarium because it provided similar opportunities for comparing a large number of living specimens. It was believed that in the natural system, nature revealed its own shape. All sorts of analogies were tried, from three-dimensional pyramids, but circular shapes were the most popular. The system garden used the analogy of a triple concentric circle with radial paths. Many botanists also felt they needed to factor into this the place that plant families fitted in a general scale of advancement or perfection. To try to find whose system was used in McCoy's garden, I compared various 19th century systems with the 1865 plant list, with reference to the progression from simple to complex plants, the range of plant groups included, the number of natural orders or families, and the coincidence of order or family names. And the closest match for the system was the system devised by this fellow, John Hutton Balfour of Edinburgh University, affectionately known to his students as Woody Fibre. This variation of his system of classification appeared in Encyclopaedia Britannica in 1854 and the second edition of his Outlines of Botany in 1862, which I found in the Biomed library, my great relief, really. McCoy was primarily a taxonomist. He wasn't publicly recognised as a botanist, but he had that Victorian compulsion to classify and order everything. So he tabulated the vegetable kingdom. For over 20 years, he claimed that his system was unique. What did the system garden look like? There appear to be only four 19th century photos of it. There are several plans and written descriptions. As noted earlier, the total area occupied about 4 acres. The garden was circular, with chamomile-edged plant arrangements fitted into three concentric circles with radial paths leading to the central conservatory, surrounded by a moat. A hedge and a bank of shelter plants surrounded the whole garden. The 1865 plant list, maps, plans, correspondence, memories and photos suggest that the garden was planted in an anti-clockwise direction, beginning at the southern gate of the outer circle, with some of the plant families mentioned there. What was grown there? Well, the 1865 plant list shows over 1,500 species in the garden, hothouse, frames and propagating house, representing about 150 of Balfour's 265 families. The number must have increased over the next 20 years, but unfortunately the only list we have is that one from 1865. In 1856, McCoy talked to the Philosophical Society of Victoria about museums. And with museums, he included the provision of a scientific botanic garden for class purposes, that is, classification and demonstration. And he said that this garden would illustrate all the natural classes, orders, and most of the families and many of the genera of plants arranged with the systematic precision of the leaves of a book and fully labelled. Each class was to have a large bed with a central label which could be read from the edge and subsequent divisions into family, genera and species were to be separated into smaller compartments with smaller labels. Everything was going to be there. The aim was to teach the principles of botanical classification as the eye of the visitor will familiarise himself insensibly with the natural alliances and affinities of the various groups of plants. In other words, he was going to learn it all by osmosis. In 1860, he wrote of his original design for illustrating the botanical arrangement of trees, plants and shrubs on a strictly methodical plan, indispensable for educational purposes of students and also useful for popular improvement and general scientific instruction. In 1875, he explained that he had originally laid out the garden on a new plan demonstrating the relationships between plants. His labelling system included information on name, native country, and botanical relationships. The aquatic orders were grown in sunken tanks in their proper places relative to terrestrial plants, and seaweeds were grown to demonstrate the difference between the simplest and most complex plants. The completion of the conservatory meant that tropical plants could be included with labels showing their relationship to plants in the outer garden. In 1880, he further explained that he had originally laid out the garden in systematic sequence of all the orders of plants. Botany lectures took place in the first term of the academic year and many plant samples were required. But of course, many plants did not flower or fruit then, so students were referred to the relevant section of the garden and furnished with orders for reference specimens at the appropriate time. However, after 1882, McCoy ceased using the garden in his teaching as he no longer had control over it. That funny little white building also represents development, decline and change. McCoy's system garden was enormously ambitious, for it aimed to display the entire plant kingdom. It was expensive. Between 1861 and 71, the costs of making and maintaining the system garden, gardener's salary, extra labour, seeds, plants, tools and part of the conservatory averaged about £368 per year. This can be compared with the average expenditure over seven of these years of £500 on the grounds as a whole and £340 on books and bookbinding. So you can see why it seems a little bit out of proportion, perhaps, considering the whole place. It was ultimately unviable in representing the whole plant kingdom because over time larger plants and trees shade out their neighbours, while annuals and short-lived plants require frequent replanting. So you get these empty spaces. This involved time, labour and money. There were also academic changes, as natural history did not enrol large numbers of students, while medicine enrolled 13 in 1865 and 137, that is, half the student body, in 1880. Medicinal botany became increasingly important and took over part of the system garden, to McCoy's disgust. The Education Act of 1872 established a network of state schools to provide free and compulsory education, so that over 300 matriculated in 1880. Within the university, there was a struggle for power in the conflict of personalities and educational policies, with supporters of the classics challenged by those who advocated scientific and modern studies. In 1889, botany officially moved from arts to science, for natural science was no longer seen as an inquiry dedicated to the collection of facts, but a science concerned with the history of nature. Major financial problems meant that in 1893, the gardening staff was reduced, salaries lowered, and the abolition of the system garden and conservatory recommended, as they were no longer required. In 1894, the system garden and conservatory were to be auctioned. William Guilfoyle accepted some of the palms for the Melbourne Botanic Garden, but said the conservatory was not worth moving. It was demolished about 1916. But fortunately, the central core remains. Ambitious, expensive, unviable, abandoned, what was the value of the system garden to students? In 1881, a former student wrote in McCoy's defence, "I can most truly say that nothing was of so great practical help to me in the study of botany as the access to the system garden, where in the course of a few minutes one could see the whole vegetable world represented from the lowest to the highest in order. Often I have walked up and down the path with my books and notes and nailed my knowledge in my mind by living examples properly arranged. I find myself constantly referring to the garden in thought for the position of some order I may meet." He may not have recognised the funny little white building, for it would have been surrounded by the conservatory, at the centre of what, at his peak, must have been an amazing garden. After McCoy, buildings and threats of building encroached on what had been the system garden, as they continue to do. This image shows the original system garden footprint compared to buildings in 1993. In conclusion, that funny little white building represents the original system garden and the way botany was taught in the 19th century. This photo shows the garden about a century ago, unloved, abandoned. Yet, thanks to Alfred James Ewart, Foundation Professor of Botany, and many others who tried to preserve the area as a botanical and agricultural precinct, something has survived. Happy birthday, System Garden. May there be many more. Thank you.
Remarkably supportive of our students and research. And just as I'm getting passionate here, but just as the system garden is so important, so is the herbarium.
Mm-hmm.
That herbarium we have is historically, and research-wise, teaching-wise, and culturally really important. And we've got good support for maintaining the herbarium. We appointed a new curator, Dr. Joe Birch, in Melbourne and before that Hawaii and before that Texas. So, and we have a very strong group of students. So systematic botany and the herbarium is really strong. And here's a herbarium fund brochure that I have put out here, which unashamedly is about trying to attract some money to ensure the long-term strength of the herbarium. We've raised nearly $500,000. My goal is to get it to $1 million.
If I could just add to that, the systems gardens and herbaria are not just, you know, things that we care about for historical reasons. In fact, much of the research that I showed you today used 4 or 5 different herbaria during my PhD. I used the herbarium at this very university. I used samples to get electromicrographs to do my research. I used systems gardens to collect plant matter to do my research. They're absolutely vital for cutting-edge molecular research, as well as the incredible historical perspective they give us.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. And that was unsolicited. But it's true. I mean, there's a great unsurge, actually, in systematic research because of the importance of biodiversity conservation. And the herbarium is a record of collections. It's also where we put our samples, where all the DNA comes from, people's analysis. So a couple of brochures here. I've talked enough. Forgive me for doing that,
Steve,
but it seems not appropriate given your wonderful talk. Questions of Gwen?
You alluded to the power struggle in Victorian era when medicine started to dominate the enrolments of students. Can you tell us more about the role of system gardens in teaching medicine or botany, which was so very important?
Well, a lot of plants had medicinal uses, and I think it was more a power struggle between personalities than anything else. McCoy believed that his garden could provide the plants as it was, because he covered the whole plant kingdom, so surely they could be just planted in the right places. But the infighting just meant that the specifically medicinal plants that they wanted were not provided. I think personally that it was a way to get rid of it altogether. That the smaller pharmaceutical section of it could be concentrated rather than having to support all the rest of the plant kingdom.
So was there a medicinal botanist employed, or did
no.
George Halford?
No, there wasn't. There was pharmaceutical sort of links there. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the person concerned. So you have to look at the university history, possibly.
I'm interested in that sort of thread of inquiry as well, around whether there's very good records of what was considered significant pharmacologically then, in terms of what those plants would have been.
That they wanted him to grow. No, I'm sorry, I can't. I never didn't look in that particular area.
McCoy kept claiming that it was, he'd done something really new in having this garden laid out, and you identified that it was Balfour's system that he used.
Yeah.
So what was the new thing that McCoy
including claimed? The whole lot, the whole plant kingdom. The normal way was to just have annuals or possibly some perennials. And that was the case in some of the English system gardens. But he wanted the whole world. That was why he had the aquatics.
In 4 acres.
Oh, yes. Well, I suppose if you just put type specimens in. But a lot of... there was a lot of fighting because he had a wish list of the plants he wanted, and Godfrey Howe said, look, I'm sorry, some of them aren't available in Australia. Where are you going to get them from? There's no harm in trying, I think, with McCoy's way of getting what he wanted.
I'm the widow of a reader in botany. Quite some time ago, he retired in 1984. Now, I don't know...
This is Kingsley Rowan.
I don't know whether it was before the war or after. He lived in the middle of the war, his undergrad, and he used to go excursions on the McCoy Society.
Now, you
had something to do with this. Iona is a Master of Science in Botany. Now the biosciences.
Yes, there was a McCoy Society that there was an island off Warrnambool that they did quite
That's
a lot
right.
of work on.
And I think Kingsley was collecting some plants from there.
He may well have done.
Yes.
I remember him more collecting algae, seaweeds.
I don't think he got into algae then.
Frederick Wood Jones was very important in that course of time.
Sorry?
Frederick Wood Jones was very important in the course of time in the 20s and 30s.
Yes, it was almost saying, look, McCoy did leave something behind. We'll name this society in his honour. He wasn't particularly loved while he was alive, however.
Yes. Was Ferdinand von Mulbrot associated with the gardens at all?
Only in the sense that the botany community wasn't large and there was interaction on a more personal level, but he wasn't directly connected.
So
with
he didn't supply plants?
No, I think the world wasn't quite big enough for both McCoy and Muir at the same time.
Yes?
One of the things I found fascinating about the iteration of the history of the gardens was it almost demonstrates those changing attitudes to the natural sciences, and you mentioned that in terms of the shift in focus early in the piece, but also there is a naivety ecologically that you talk about with the annuals and the perennials not necessarily interacting as McCoy might have wanted them to. Can you comment more on that, the gardens as a reflection of the evolution of science itself and the study of nature?
Well, I guess systems have moved on. Like, nobody now uses Balfour's system, do they? he was just one of the 24 or more that were around at that stage. It was very much in a state of flux. So I think that is another way. Look, systems now are much more well, microscopically based and so on. You know, they're not using the same Victorian naturalists.
Higher level classifications now are based on phylogenetic analyses, so if you like an evolutionary tree, and a lot of the data for that are coming from DNA sequencing and whole genome sequencing. But it's remarkable that the major groups still kind of hang together. Family Rotaceae's a good family, Proteaceae's a good family, the orders, the higher level.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that there's not a lot of change going on. But you couldn't have a system garden that reflected the whole of the, say, the angiosperm classification. Take over the whole of the university, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, it's a suggestion, isn't it?
When did it start? When did the garden start to look like this? And also, is it just a smattering?
I think that's more Tim's.
Come on, Tim, we have the gardeners here. When did the garden start looking like this?
Yeah, probably the last 13 or so years we worked with botany and redefined where the subclasses were and built them appropriately and tried to have a complete collection.
But you need someone with passion and who's really dedicated to it. It was just sort of part of the grounds, and then when Tim took over, he made it his own and just said, we're going to restore it back and make it something.
Tim and you, Virginia, have both also taken courses. You've come along and done our Francis Banks courses.
Yeah.
You've gone off to psyched conferences in South America. And you've planted some areas here that are more ecological grouping, something like the rainforest, as distinct from a bed of an order or a family.
Yeah, we try to go beyond just a system garden by having, well, we have the research area where people can grow. There's, you know, there's grapes, Shiraz grapes growing there now, and the eucalyptus for the oils. And then, yeah, the rainforest garden where we can focus on Australian ferns and palms and epiphytic plants as well. And it's all good for teaching. It's still a very highly used as a teaching garden.
Well, I'm not sure if this question is to Gwen or Tim or both of you together, but are there any plants surviving in the garden that we think were from the time when it was operating as a system garden? And if so, what are there any we can spot out the window?
Yeah, the cordwine over there, near next to the in front of the bamboo.
Right.
That's meant to be a McCoy planting. And in the tower in the 1880s image in there, you can actually see the same plant in the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
The McClura plumifera on the other side, which is a heritage listed tree, that's from and also the palms as well. Yeah.
I think that one more
question. Just a question to you, Polly. When did botany lose its gardeners? Like in the 80s, we had a couple of botany department gardeners. When did it become part of the general campus?
Did we have botany gardeners?
There was Bob and another guy.
We had people looking after the glasshouses.
Okay. But that's part of the system garden as well, didn't
you? Yeah, they did.
Yeah, and then
it became
part of general
campus.
Yeah.
Oh,
sorry,
1989. Oh,
there you are.
So, yeah, Carrick Chambers employed a couple, and one of the curators was here earlier from the 80s.
Well,